This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Welcome to our Friday pitch-in. We always start our Friday show with a recap of the state's biggest headlines with our Indiana Public Broadcasting digital producer, Lauren Chapman. Hi, Lauren.
Hey, Matt.
It's been a busy week for you. Well, it's always a busy week for you, isn't it?
Yes, to say the very least, yes.
the very least. All right, we've got a lot of news to get through, so we'll leave it at the very least. And we'll start as we've been doing since March, when you came back after the session was over with, and we'll look at the week's numbers from COVID-19.
Yeah, as of noon, 2,765 people have died from COVID-19
since the onset of the pandemic.
Yeah. There are more than 66,000 confirmed cases and more than 747,000 Hoosiers have been tested. To compare that to last week's numbers, 2,687 people had died as of last week. There were 60,000 confirmed cases and more than 678,000 Hoosiers who had been tested. And so the confirmed cases are continuing to climb. Thursday's newly reported cases was the second highest the state had recorded at 960, which the record was set last week on Friday at more than 1,000 cases reported in a single day.
All right. And it looks like we are staying in the current phase that we've been stuck in since the beginning of July for another month.
Yeah, that recent spike, in addition to prompting the governor to issue the mask mandate, which we heard about last week, has also led the governor to extend this current stage through August 27th. So this is where we will be at for the next month. What that means is restaurants are restricted to 75% capacity and limits and bars and nightclubs and other entertainment venues are limited to 50% capacity. Gatherings of any kind are restricted to 250 people unless there's approval from a local health department. And of course, the language in his executive order, similar to all of the previous orders, is that counties can impose stricter guidelines than the state. So, for example, Indianapolis shut down bars and nightclubs, I believe, a week ago at this point. Time has no meaning. required in-person school reopenings actually be delayed until August 5th. So right now, Holcomb says he doesn't see a need to reimpose past restrictions statewide, but he has said multiple times before that if it is necessary for us to go back into previous stages or even to go back to a stay-at-home order, that he is willing and ready to do so.
Okay. And let's take a look at an issue that has gotten some national headlines. We won't touch on the national issue of vote by mail because it is big, it is contentious, and it is there's a lot that has happened, transpired in the last 48 hours. But let's take a look at, the Indiana angle of this on vote by mail.
Yeah. So this week has seen a handful of conversations about what expanded vote by mail, should look like, will look like, could look like in November. Indiana has a very strict absentee voting restrictions. It is one of the most restrictive in the entire country. And Governor Eric Holcomb said, I believe last week, that vote by mail should be expanded, but only if the state is under another stay-at-home order. So that would be, complete lockdown sort of situation. But several groups, including Common Cause Indiana, the League of Women Voters of Indiana, and the ACLU of Indiana, and the Greater Indianapolis NAACP, all want the state to expand vote by mail to anyone who wants it for the November 3rd election. And in fact, you will hear reporting from our State House reporter, Brandon Smith, talking about Common Cause and the NAACP filing a lawsuit over Indiana's vote by mail deadline. For Monday, for most folks, you should hear a story from him as well about former lieutenant governors calling for expanded vote by mail.
Oh, okay. And my email inbox was flooded this morning on the news of that lawsuit, and maybe that's something that we will cover soon here on All In. All right, so another thing that is related to the pandemic, everything is related to the pandemic, the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures, what's happened with that?
Yeah, that moratorium was extended for another couple of weeks. So Governor Eric Holcomb announced Wednesday he's extending that moratorium through August 14th, which means Hoosier renters and homeowners will be shielded from evictions and foreclosures. He emphasized, though, that those who have struggled with payments need to work with their landlords and mortgage holders. And Indiana's rental assistance program, which opened in July, already has received more than 20,000 applications, more than the state anticipated it could serve. I believe their conservative estimate was that they would be able to help about 12,000 folks. And Holcomb has said that the state will find more resources for its program if the initial funding is exhausted. The governor also said he isn't going to let a new lawsuit affect future decision making over potential further extensions of that moratorium. A group of landlords recently sued Holcomb in federal court, alleging the moratorium violates their constitutional rights. Holcomb said he's confident in his legal standing.
Okay. All right. So the moratorium is extended and lots of other issues tangential to that. And so also we got the news on Wednesday of this week that a former governor passed away.
Yeah. Joe Kernan, a former South Bend mayor and 48th governor of Indiana, died early Wednesday morning at the age of 74 after living with Alzheimer's disease. He served as a naval lieutenant during the Vietnam War. He and his co-pilot were shot down on a reconnaissance mission over North Vietnam in 1972, where he spent 11 months as a prisoner of war. In 1974, he returned to South Bend to work in business, and his political career began in 1980 when former South Bend Mayor Roger Parent asked him to serve as the city controller in his administration. He was elected as mayor in 1987 and served three consecutive terms before moving into state politics. He served as Indiana's lieutenant governor under Frank O'Bannon from 1997 to 2003, and after O'Bannon died from a stroke in September 2003, Kernan filled O'Bannon's term as governor until 2005 and made Kathy Davis the state's first woman to serve as lieutenant governor. He lost his reelection bid to Republican Mitch Daniels in 2004.
Yeah, from the Hanoi Hilton to the governor's mansion, quite the story and quite the life Joe Kernan led. And we had former Indiana First Lady Judy O'Bannon on the show on the very day that Joe Kernan passed away. And we got some very nice words from her about Joe Kernan at the top of the show. And boy, what a great guest she was on Wednesday. If you want to go back and listen to the podcast of that episode, we talked for an hour on, well, she talked for an hour. I didn't really have to say much. She's a very talkative woman. And she was such a delight. We talked about historic preservation on Wednesday's show. So go back into the podcast feed and check that out. Okay, so some people have been receiving mystery seeds in the mail. I am not one of them, but if you get them, and a lot of people have, what are they supposed to, what is this about?
This is my favorite story of the entire week.
Oh, boy.
It enchants and delights me in every single way. I'm not the kind of person who's really into conspiracy theories. I think the world is horrifying enough with the information that we do know that we don't have to make up things in order to make it more exciting. However, the seeds feel like they fit perfectly into 2020 with murder hornets and plague, and it's just a perfect sprinkle on top. So people in Indiana and around the country are receiving seeds in the mail from China that they didn't order. State and federal officials are urging residents not to plant the seeds or throw them away where they could end up growing in landfills. Don Robeson, a seed administrator for the Office of the Indiana State Chemist, said from the photos the office has received, some of the seeds look to be, you know, sunflower, maybe cucumber, wheat, or a mixture of things. And so the state chemist was a little concerned that these could also be noxious weeds, which are an invasive species that could disrupt Indiana's ecosystem. Indiana U.S. Representative Jim Banks said the seeds could be a brushing scam where a company makes a fake review of their product online by sending it to your address. However, no matter what it is, if you receive a packet of seeds from China, the state chemist wants you to send it to the state plant health director, which is the dopest title there has ever been or ever will be. And if you've already planted them, you need to contact the DNR Division of Entomology and Plant Pathology. This story, which was reported by our environment reporter, Rebecca Thiel, who also included a whole section about trade secret espionage that's also part of this, has contact information for both. And I will tweet it and tag all in on Twitter so that you can get that contact information.
Good heavens.
It's a very serious thing to make sure that you are, you know, turning over the seeds to somebody else to make sure that they aren't, you know, devastating our ecosystem at the same point in time. This is so wild and weird that I cannot help but gain joy from it.
Mm. So the state chemist wants us to send it to the state plant health director. Mm-hmm. Again, that contact information is in Becky's story. And if you've already planted them, contact the DNR Division of Entomology and Plant Pathology. And again, go to Rebecca Thiel's story for that contact information. Let's see. Lauren, we had a great Facebook Live. Well, the Facebook Live was a bit of a bust due to some technical issues, but we turned it into yesterday's show. Mm-hmm. But we got some of the questions from the Indiana 2022 Way that we shared on the Facebook Live on Thursday. What is the Indiana 2022 Way and how can we join?
Yeah, the Indiana 2022 Way is our way of connecting with you, the folks who are listening to this conversation. It's a two-way in radio is just one reporter and one person telling us things that they find interesting. So to join, text elections to 73224 to join the Indiana 2022 Way. Of course, we will be covering COVID-19, but we're also going to focus on the elections, and especially as we continue barreling closer to November 3rd, that Venn diagram is just going to have greater overlap.
Indeed. All right. Lauren Chapman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And speaking of two ways, we got a couple coming your way next. First, with Sarah Cooper from our affiliate WNIN in Evansville with some tragic news about an e-learning leader in Indiana who passed away suddenly last week. We'll get all of the info we have from her next. I'm Matt Pelser. That's in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. As Indiana students go back to school, many of them virtually, they have a woman named Candace Dodson to thank for Indiana Education's move into the digital realm. Even before the pandemic, she worked to optimize and normalize e-learning for Hoosier kids. Well, last week, we got the tragic news that she died suddenly. I'm joined by Sarah Cooper, who's been reporting on this from our affiliate station WNIN in Evansville. Hi, Sarah.
Hi there.
So what do we know about Candace Dodson's death?
So the Evansville Police Department tells us that on July 22nd at around 9:20, Dodson was driving an SUV near the Evansville Regional Airport when she collided with a semi-truck. Candace was killed in the crash, and the passenger, her husband, Robert Dodson, was taken to the hospital. We've just learned that he has passed away from his injuries. The two had been married for 34 years. They leave behind a daughter and a son and two grandchildren.
Mm. And what have you heard from her colleagues?
So I talked with several of her colleagues last Friday. They were still reeling from the shock. Some found it even too difficult to talk with me on the phone. So we just exchanged emails. What I found in common among all those that I talked with is that at every stage of her career, even as a fifth grade teacher, she made those around her excited about technology, telling them it was the key to advancing education. Her passion seemed to be infectious. Her drive to further education technology led her to leadership positions within, you know, locally, the Evansville-Vandenberg County School Corporation, but then on to the State Department of Education, where she became the director of e-learning. for the state. And I talked with, in particular, Jason Roseberry, who had some good comments just about her personality.
I mean, when you picture Candace, it's just always so much energy and so much passion and so much heart. And it was just always on. Like, I never saw her not on.
So it just seems like she was one of those people who just couldn't help it, couldn't turn it off. And it was just infectious to others. So I found it interesting that people she had worked with had worked with her in several roles over the past 20 years, meaning that it seems like throughout her career, she recognized people who shared her passion and then brought them along with her to create tools and resources for Indiana teachers. It's people she had longstanding relationships with. And a byproduct of those close working relationships seemed to be close personal relationships. I had colleagues tell me she was just had become family over the years.
You don't even realize that you're becoming such close friends with someone like Candace or any, I don't know anybody that's like that. And so what I would say is it doesn't hit you until she's gone that you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't even realize she was one of my closest friends.
And Matt, that was everyone I talked to said, had a line just like that. So it seemed like she had a big impact on a lot of people.
Mm. Coincidentally, one of the initiatives she worked on was launched on the day of her death. Can you tell me about the Indiana e-learning lab? What was it for?
Sure. So the e-learning lab, if you look at it online, it's just a hub of resources like lesson plans and webinars for teachers. Plus, there are these interactive features that put educators in touch with experts in technology. There's a forum area where teachers can share back and forth experiences and best practices, things that worked, things that were failures. You know, there's a program where teachers can track their progress as they educate themselves. It's free to educators all over the state. You just have to make an account.
And Candace Dodson was also involved in e-learning at the national level. What'd she do?
Yes. So in May of 2019, Candace took this national leadership position as the executive director of the State Educational Technology Directors Association. So after working for decades in Indiana, she was, you know, training teachers and innovating with colleagues. She took that experience and expertise and started doing it with educators from all 50 states. So just getting together, collaborating on new things that were working maybe in one state that could be shared with another state. So that's where she had been since May of 2019.
So is that work at work here in Indiana? Are we kind of testing the waters on this to see if it works?
So from what I gather, that's the plan. When I talked with Jason Roseberry, he said her idea was to watch how teachers use the e-learning lab here in Indiana and then take the model and cater it to other states. Roseberry told me she was brainstorming tweaks already that they could make that would serve counties and school districts on the East and West Coast.
And as we've said, she was working on and promoting the idea of e-learning even before the pandemic. What have you heard from people about this interest that she had and had always had in e-learning?
So as you know, technology and virtual learning have become a larger part of schooling in the last 5 years or so. But Candace was predicting these trends 20 years ago, it seems. A colleague in front of her joked to me that she had always wanted to have like t-shirts printed up that say, I told you so, about how, you know, educators would be turning to e-learning. And this was all pre, you know, coronavirus. So it just seemed like she always had this vision that e-learning was a way that students could learn outside of school, whether it was because of a snow day or because of, you know, illness, or they could still be connected to teachers and to, you know, the world through all of these different e-learning sort of collaborations. So it seemed like she had a vision for that, you know, back when she was a fifth grade teacher, you know.
Prophetic, to be sure. And WNIN did a story on Candace Dodson back in April. What was it about?
Back in April, she was helping us sort through distance learning, which was brand new to lots of teachers and parents in particular. Mm-hmm. She told us that she was seeing groups of teachers come together with solutions, but also, you know, in DC, she had large companies and vendors calling her and trying to put their heads together about how to help out, you know, this sort of sudden switch to just strictly e-learning. She walked us through how many teachers felt comfortable using e-learning as a way to review material, but they were nervous about introducing new topics and covering new ground with students, which is, of course, what may well be happening here in a few weeks. So, you know, back in April, it was just kind of, we talked with her about what was happening in the here and now, and then now realizing that even then she was sort of laying some groundwork for helping out this eventuality of a sort of blended virtual and in-class learning that we'll be seeing here soon.
And before she was elevated to the state level and then, of course, later the national level on education and e-learning, she was a teacher, a fifth grade teacher there in Evansville. Where'd she teach?
Sure. So she was a fifth grade teacher at Cedar Hall Elementary School. And then after doing that for a time, she moved over to being the media specialist at Dexter Elementary. That's on the east side. And then after that, she began working for the school corporation as a technology specialist. So early started in the fifth grade and then quickly moved into technology.
We've been talking about Candace Dodson and her work on Indiana's move into the digital realm as far as education goes. She died suddenly last week, and we've been talking with Sarah Cooper, who reports for WNIN in Evansville. Sarah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now, with the month of May, I mean August, upon us, we're looking forward to the Indy 500, but it'll be very different this year. For one thing, it's August. For another thing, well, let's just say this year's race could be the most unique 500 in history. Joining me now is Indiana Public Broadcasting Samantha Horton. Hi, Sam.
Hey, Matt. Thanks for having me.
So I think one of the most noticeable differences this year will be the number of fans. How many people will be able to buy tickets this year?
So, yeah, Matt, that is, I think, one of the big things that's going to be very noticeable this year. They have reduced the amount of people that will be able to buy tickets and be in attendance to 25% of the typical amount. Now, the typical amount has never officially been released by IMS, but it's been estimated between 200,000 to 300,000 fans. So you're looking at least possibly 50,000 fans still there for the Indy 500 this year, but still, that's a huge drop compared to what people would typically see if they flipped their TV on and saw all the fans at the race that usually is in May.
Yeah, and this year it's on Sunday, August 23rd. So how has that number, the number of fans that will be allowed in, how has that number changed over the last few months?
Yeah, Matt, it's been dropped several times here now, a couple of times actually. And so it started out with the race being postponed. And then,
so up until a month ago, they were considering full capacity for the August race?
Yes. Yeah, they just postponed it. I think like a lot of events and things that have been postponed to later dates just had a goal of, you know, hoping that maybe the first wave of the virus would be it and possibly things could start reopening and be fully up and running. That's the impression that I had. Others, you know, at least Penske and officials had been pretty set on having people in attendance for this race. And up until the end of June was the first that they finally rolled out the plan of only doing 50%.
But that has changed since then.
Yes, about a month later. So they've reduced it now again to only 25%. So it's been a shift there of just dwindling that number down a bit as it's become clear that COVID-19 isn't going away quite as quickly maybe as some had hoped. And so that is something that now is being played into precautions to try to spread people out as much as they can at the track.
So 25% capacity, hopefully that'll do the trick. What about other precautions?
Yeah, so that's only one thing in an 88-page report that they IMS officials rolled out not long ago. And the other factors are including they'll be doing temperature checks at the gates. So if someone has a temperature, I believe, of 100.4 degrees, they will be tested a second time to just make sure that that was an accurate reading. And if they are still above that temperature, they'll be asked to leave then. And then for those who are cleared to come into the speedway there, they will be then given a face mask and hand sanitizer. And so they're doing that. They're also spreading out seating in the stands and throughout the whole facility and having restrictions on where people can eat food and trying to really practice things. But I mean, there's a lot of questions still up in the air of like, will that be enough? Will that be enough to really keep the spectators safe?
Well, and enforcement, too. Is say, the mask rule, will that be enforced?
From what we talked about, IMS President Doug Bowles said that he plans on enforcing that. And if people refuse to wear a mask, they will be asked to leave.
Major League Baseball started up last weekend without fans in the seats. They're not taking any chances. Why not just run the race without spectators?
Yeah, Penske has been, Roger Penske, who just purchased Indianapolis Motor Speedway, is pretty adamant about having fans in the stands for this race. He did an interview a while back ago with a racing publication and made it clear that the only way he will run the Indy 500 is with fans there. So he has been really set on this, and it is a lot of money. There's a lot of revenue on the line for the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, as well as the local economy that relies on this race, usually in May.
So there will be fans, but plenty of precautions. This could be one of the biggest gatherings in the country, I guess, since the onset of the pandemic. Does the Speedway seem concerned about that?
That is a great question, Matt, and I think that's something that a lot of people are asking. And I know recently Indiana University health officials have just made a comment that really the Indy 500 for fans to be there is not safe. And so there's started to be some pushback that is this really the right move to make? But in the press conference that we had with some of the IMS officials recently, they are working with a medical doctor, Ed Rack, has helped IMS officials develop the plan that they released. And his comment when asked, is this almost an experiment? He felt that that is not the word he would use. And he quote said, it's an application of some pretty strict criteria in a large population to minimize that transmission as they move across the board. So there's a lot of questions of maybe it's not being officially looked at as a experiment in that term. But at the same time, I would think that a lot of public health officials are going to be watching this to see what happens.
So this will be Roger Penske's first 500 as owner, as we've said. Surely he was hoping for a better year than this, as we all were. And he was preparing for this to be a great 500. How has he been improving the track since he bought it earlier this year?
Yeah, Matt. So Penske's been really big on improving the fan experience. So it's been a lot of investment that he's put into track. He's just really been focusing on how can we improve some of these elements that really people who attend the race would interact with on a substantial basis to improve that relationship with them in the track. And another one was the connectivity with improving telecommunications there. So I know 5G was something that was going to be used at the track there, and fans could possibly use that to try to get some more real-time information during the race to have a better idea of what's happening while watching it.
Under normal circumstances, the 500 isn't just the race. It's the whole month of May. Pole day, bump day, carb day, or any of those events being held too?
So pole day is still on track to happen, Matt. And while a lot of events have been canceled with the Indy 500, because when you look at it, it's the entire month of May is made into an Indy 500 festivities and all these events that surround it. But the bare bones of what make the Indy 500 with pole day included there plan to happen. So they're trying to make as much as they can happen that have obviously been reduced to what it is now.
And the town of Speedway sees a big bump in business during the month of May. How's that going to be different this year?
Yeah, so that's I think one of the big things here that's happening is when you look at the economic impact that the Indy 500 has. And I know a study from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway back in 2000 put the economic impact of this race at more than $300 million. So there's been a lot of money on the line. And I think that's really part of what's pulling to continue to try to have fans in the stands and try to have people there. It's a tradition. Some people feel really, you know, connected with this race on a more than just a spectator fan of auto sports, but just the history of it all. But then at the same time, there's also that financial business side of it all that really how much money really drives into this local economy and the state with this race. So businesses in Speedway rely on the month of May usually to bring in some foot traffic, and that's not really going to happen this year. So I think it's really going to be interesting to see with this local area and the state how much some of these events, including the Indy 500 that brings in a lot of revenue, what might change with this reduced capacity of fans and just limited events around the race itself.
And I just did some quick math. $336 million in 2000 is over half a billion in today's dollars. So if that is still sort of the estimate, then the town of Speedway surely is missing out on a lot of revenue. I mean, we knew they would be anyway. So what else are you planning on looking into ahead of the race?
So it's really looking at, I think, the big things to take away and the focus points are going to be the public health aspect of this, with the fact that this race is still planning on having fans in the stands. I think that's something that a lot of eyes are going to be watching and continuing to follow as IMS officials look at and update possibly the plan for the race. And then also just the business impact. You know, this is a big part for Indiana's, not just Speedway, but Indiana economy as well, when you think of the taxes and everything else that go into play here. So I think those are some of the major things that are going to be to follow, and just kind of watching how this all plays out. This is a constantly evolving story. So it's something that just pretty much following along and seeing what changes in the upcoming weeks will be, I think, some of the critical things to follow.
She's our business and economic reporter. She's also covering this year's very different Indianapolis 500-mile race. Samantha Horton, thanks.
Thanks, Matt. Appreciate it.
Up next, one Indiana man's emotional journey to right the wrongs of his ancestors is spelled out in a new book. I'll talk to the author of A History of Racism next. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. My next guest grew up hearing stories about a slave his family had freed when they moved from Virginia to Indiana back in the early 1800s. Like many stories, though, it got more complicated when he looked closer. He spent years trying to find details that might point to the validity of certain aspects of the story. And he got a few answers. He's turned the physical and emotional journey of these efforts into the new book, A History of Racism. Jeff Purvis, welcome.
Thank you.
Let me just say first off that I loved this book. It's beautifully written. It's honest, sometimes uncomfortably so, as many of these kinds of personal reflections are. I want to start with a particularly uncomfortable reality that a lot of people, including myself to a degree, have to reckon with. And that's the fact that you grew up around and were complicit in a fairly significant degree of racism. What did that look like when you were growing up?
Well, it wasn't anything that I was really conscious of. I mean, that's the bottom line. This is a consciousness that I've only come to over the years. Because it was universal in the family, in the neighborhood, in the school that I grew up in. It was just a fact of life. It wasn't any different than, I don't know, tap water at the sink. It was just there. And it wasn't until I got into high school and particularly into college that I really started to understand that it was a problem, and it was something I needed to address in my life.
And some of it came from your mother, who you describe in the book, and I'm not going to quote here because I don't have it in front of me, but you describe her as a very intelligent person.
Extremely.
But she was indoctrinated into that same sort of racism that you were, or maybe even to a greater degree, when she was a child.
Oh, certainly. And I mean, a great deal of her feelings came from her family of origin, because they still, and I recognize this later in some of the speech patterns that she had, some of the food that she cooked, some of the traditions that she kept, but she was still very much influenced by generations old Southern culture. They brought that culture with them here to Indiana, and she was still very much part of it.
And in the book, you wrote of a friend named John, who was, as you described, the very first person of my generation I'd ever gotten to know who was proactively anti-racist. That's a quote from the book. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you met John in the mid-60s. How unusual was that at that time to know somebody like that?
It was really unusual. I mean, it wasn't just me that was struck by his attitudes. It was everybody around him. I mean, again, the culture was largely racist, not overtly so. It was a subtle kind of racism, maybe the most dangerous kind. But John absolutely stood out against that. And I spoke with him recently after he read the book, and you know, he recalled that it was really hurtful to him. He came here, I think they moved here from Michigan, and his father was a Lutheran pastor. He was just in an entirely different environment than I had been as a kid, and he found the culture here absolutely jarring.
Tell me about this family story that got this whole thing started, the ancestor that ended up in Indiana. What was the story you heard growing up?
Well, I'm going to refrain from using the exact language that I heard it expressed in, but the idea was that sometime back in the 1800s, an ancestor had moved here from Virginia with his family, with a few of his possessions, and with one slave whom he had freed, and to make a new life. We don't really know why. The story I heard was really garbled. It was conflated with stories from a number of other ancestors, as I found out. But the story was that somehow he had been cut out of his father's inheritance except for this one slave and a few physical items, and so came here to start a new life. And he freed the slave. That was always the story. And when they moved to Indiana, the slave was so devoted to the family that he stayed on with the family and became a devoted family member, as I recall it, and eventually was buried in our family cemetery.
And so that set you on this journey to learn more, this quest for the truth. It started off locally, Franklin Township, actually, just southeast of Indianapolis. What'd you find?
Yeah, exactly. Well, sadly, I didn't find much. It turns out that in order for an enslaved person to be freed, there actually had to be a legal proceeding, a court procedure, that would have resulted in certain records being kept and the issuance of what was called a certificate of manumission. It was this, you know, infamous document that freed slaves had to carry with them and produce on demand, or else they could be seized immediately. And so my wife and I went to Virginia, went through the courthouse records, and really couldn't find any. Curiously, the records only went back to the very year my ancestor left Virginia. But there was no record of any freeing or issuing of a certificate of manumission or any of that. Given the historical context, though, of what I know about the culture of the time and the fact, too, that according to family lore, they were on their way to St. Louis, or in one rendition of the story, they were on their way to Kansas. Both were hotbeds of slavery. St. Louis was, I believe, the number one slave market in the country at the time. It makes no sense that this far-ahead-thinking individual, my ancestor, who allegedly freed this person, would have been heading for those places. And instead, they stayed in Indiana, where slavery was officially illegal, had been outlawed by the first Constitution, but it was still largely practiced on a de facto basis.
So you didn't find this evidence that you needed that would prove that Price, the slave, was freed. And so that didn't sit well with you. And you also, as I understand, could not find the grave that he was supposedly buried in, but you found what you are pretty sure was.
Yeah, I did. All that's correct. You have to remember that as far back as any of the relatives could remember, the story had been that Price was buried in the family cemetery. And in fact, the Franklin Township custodian even had heard the story. It was just, you know, kind of widely known in that area that this person was buried in our family's cemetery. But there was no headstone. There was no marker, nothing. And we looked really hard for it. And so, no, we never found anything. But one day, I believe I found it in the far corner of the cemetery, away from the main group of family that was buried. And I have since learned that that's exactly where those individuals were buried. People who had casual relationships with the family, like servants, like slaves, that's where they went. Sometimes they went just outside the family plot. But I believe I found Price and maybe two other graves in that far corner.
We're talking to Jeff Purvis, the author of A History of Racism, My Search for Atonement, Understanding, and a Freed Soul. And we're talking about the process that he went through to memorialize a family slave who you grew up thinking and hearing had been freed by your family, but you later found out or concluded that that probably was not the case. So then you found the grave. You didn't find the records. You concluded that he was probably not freed. What did you decide you had to do then at that point?
Well, it never occurred to me that he could be in there without a gravestone. I mean, that's how ignorant I was. But it was actually an aunt that pointed out to me that he never had a marker. And so after the events in Charlottesville and just really being flabbergasted that there was no memorial of any kind for this man who, regardless of whether he'd been freed or not, had lived his entire life with my family, but wasn't even afforded any kind of memorial. And so I decided that I was going to put in a gravestone, a headstone. And that's exactly what we did.
And what does the headstone say?
Well, I'm quoting from memory here, but I believe it says, "Price Joyce, dates known only to God, free at last."
And I have the book in front of me, so yes, that is correct. That's exactly what it says. You held a service as well with a lot of family and friends, and it was really, really poignant.
It was. And I've always been mystified as to why this story has touched me the way it has. But even now, it's difficult for me to reflect on it without getting emotional about it. But yeah, we did. We had one sunny Saturday, May morning, we had a memorial service for Price, dedicated the stone, and there were probably 15 people there, and it was really, really cool. And I felt that some sort of closure had been reached. It's, you know, as I said at the time, it's too little too late, but it was something we could do, and that's what we did.
You mentioned Charlottesville briefly. What was it about what happened in Charlottesville in 2017 that sort of drove this effort?
Well, first of all, I was shocked. I mean, I had no idea there was so much overt and public hatred still out there that apparently there is. And Susan Breaux, the mother of the lady who was run down with a car.
Heather Heyer, yeah.
Yeah, mentioned that, you know, now's the time that if you see the opportunity to do something, if you're able to actually do something, in the face of this bigotry that, you know, you should do it. You have a moral obligation to do so. And again, this isn't much. It's a very small effort on my part that doesn't even begin to right the wrongs that were probably visited on this man. But again, it was something I could do. It was something that was in my power to do, and that's what we did.
And some people might point to that as an example of white guilt, but you point to this fear that you think a lot of white people have, that non-whites might have a right to retribution, that we have it coming to us, and that fear puts some white people on the defensive and has caused things like lynchings in the KKK and even mass incarceration. It's this idea, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that white guilt can be perverted and transform into something really ugly, right?
I think that's exactly it. I think so much of what we see, so much of the denial, so much of the violence is born out of fear. It's essentially a sneaking suspicion that, yes, our African-American brothers and sisters have a right to the anger that they feel. And we don't like to confront that. But, yeah, I think that's exactly it.
You make this really simple but impactful comparison in the book. You compare white privilege to being right-handed, this idea that the world is sort of designed for right-handed people. What do you mean by that?
Well, yeah, I think that's exactly it. My wife's left-handed. and so, you know, I've dealt for 45 years now with someone who has been forced to live in a right-handed world. And it was something I have no appreciation of because I'm right-handed and I live in that right-handed world and everything goes fine for me. But she's pointed out that scissors, desks, cash registers, coffee cups are all set up for right-handed people. And lo and behold, I recently, after the book was published, I bought a pair of left-handed scissors. Because I thought, well, if I ever have to really demonstrate this to somebody, they'll come in handy. But I don't have any more because she took them.
Of course she did. How often do you visit Price's grave?
Oh, gosh. We were out there Memorial Day. I have so far gone probably 3 times a year. I don't know. I feel his presence there. I'm absolutely convinced he's there. I have no way of proving it. I don't have any documentation. You know, in the book, I make it really clear that when I'm making conjecture and drawing conclusions, that's exactly what it is. Somehow I feel like I can visit it like an old friend. I think we're good.
Jeff Purvis is the author of A History of Racism, My Search for Atonement, Understanding, and a Freed Soul. Jeff, thanks for the book and thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, Matt.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is All In.